Welcome to At the Letters. It is Thursday, April 24th, 2025, and we are here to discuss the 12 and 13 Toronto Blue Jays losers of five in a row. But, I mean, there are a lot of directions to go here. So I am here to discuss it all with Arden Zwelling on this episode of ATL, produced by Christian Ryan, as always. Arden, you were in Houston watching the Blue Jays swing and miss and swing and pop the ball up and swing and hit it into the ground. How are you doing? And what do you make of that series?
There were some failed bunt attempts as well that you missed in there. There was one home run by Nathan Lucas.
Swing and a deep drive, right field. Cam Smith going back at the wall. See you later. A solo homer for Nathan Lucas, his first of the season. And the Blue Jays
Wouldn't have been a home run in every ballpark, but it was a home run in that ballpark. So the Blue Jays avoided the indignity of being dead last in baseball in home runs, still second last ahead of the Kansas City Royals. Look, it was as poor of a performance offensively as you are going to see at the big league level. Like, it just was bad, terrible, no good, awful, through and through, from inning one through inning 27. The Blue Jays, over those three games, score two runs on nine hits and five walks in 27 innings. The Blue Jays now are going to the Bronx to play the Yankees. On Wednesday alone, the Yankees scored more runs on more hits and more walks than the Blue Jays did over those three games in Houston. So this skid needs to come to an immediate halt by the first inning at Yankee Stadium on Friday.
Yeah, it was really rough watching this team offensively. It has been really all year. And it's, you know, Monday, okay, you're facing Hunter Brown. I get it. This guy is an elite starting pitcher. And you can see it with everything that he does. The stuff is elite. But then you're facing Ronel Blanco and Ryan Gusto, and you're kind of making them look like prime Justin Verlander and Gerrit Cole. It's just not what you need, because the pitching has been good enough for the most part to keep them in these games. And yet we are looking at a situation where this team is out of balance and they are not finding the power. They are not hitting enough home runs, with only 13 on the season through almost 1,000 plate appearances for the team. So you scale that to kind of a season's worth for a hitter, you'd be looking at a hitter who would hit something like seven home runs in the course of a full season. It has been really a lack of power, and not only from the top guys. Obviously, Vladdy, Bo, Santander, they're not hitting for power, but sometimes you see these guys emerge kind of out of nowhere on other teams, and they give you a Tyler Soderstrom. Hey, he has eight home runs, and you're able to get that production. Ben Rice, boom. Yankees getting more production. This happens throughout the major leagues. The Jays haven't had that. They've had some guys who have had pretty good seasons, like a Miles Straw or a Tyler Heineman, but they're not contributing that power. And that was so evident against the Astros this week. And it just, you know, it's not a good feeling. It doesn't give you a real chance to win. And then it puts so much pressure on the pitching staff. So this team offensively is in a really rough spot.
Yeah, how about Ben Rice for just like a little more nightmare fuel for Blue Jays fans who are thinking, oh, you know, the Yankees, like, Stanton's hurt and Gerrit Cole goes down. You know, how are they going to replace some of this production? And then, like, here comes Ben Rice, 12th round pick in 2021, and he shows up this year in his sophomore season after like struggling substantially in 2024. And what's he doing? He's got a 191 weighted runs created plus. And he's got all those homers that you mentioned, and you look under the hood and the contact quality is incredible and the swing decisions are sound, and it's like Giancarlo who? Like DJ LeMay who? You know? Yeah. Just typical boohoo Blue Jays event to happen.
Because you look at the Yankees, and of course the Yankees are most frightening because they can sign Aaron Judge, you know, for $360 million. They can go sign Max Fried to an eight-year deal. They can go get Devin Williams, all this sort of thing that you do as a big market team. But they are simultaneously developing position players like Austin Wells to toss in there. Here's Ben Rice. Here's Jason Dominguez. Here's Anthony Volpe. This is huge for the direction of their franchise. Same with the Red Sox. So I'm not trying to dunk on the Blue Jays in saying this. I'm just trying to say that these teams are in good positions long-term and medium-term because they have these young players on the cusp of the major leagues. Now, look, could Alan Rodon or Will Wagner be the Blue Jays' answer to that? Maybe at some point, but neither one of those guys is really hitting right now. And the same goes for, you know, Addison Barger or Andrés Giménez, Alejandro Kirk, any of the guys that you might group into the young core of the Blue Jays, they are not hitting.
And, you know, the Blue Jays have been facing some tough pitching over the last 7 to 8 days. When you go from like Schwellenbach to Strider, the three guys at the Mariners, Wu, Gilbert, and Castillo. And then you get Hunter Brown, who's like early Cy Young front runner on Friday. Like, these are aces. These are really difficult pitchers to get hits against. But the pitchers that the Yankees are facing drive nice cars, too. Like, this is the majors. This is the highest level of competition. If you have a flat fastball that doesn't really move very much and is like 92, you aren't in this league. You're in this league because you have like two or three different fastballs, you know, a four that rides up and a two that moves arm side and maybe even like one that cuts to your glove side. And you're in the big leagues because you can locate secondary pitches and land them for strikes and force hitters to honor them. You know, if you're just like a stock righty with a 92 mile per hour fastball and a slider that moves less than a foot, you're at AAA, like you're just not here. So the Blue Jays are going to be facing good pitching, just like the Yankees have been facing good pitching, just like all the other teams that are off to better offensive starts face good pitching regularly. And Ronel Blanco and Ryan Gusto do not fit into that category of aces, of really, really good elite pitching. And, you know, Blanco has almost confoundingly had the Blue Jays number for some reason, but, you know, they got two looks at him last year. The first one, obviously the no-hitter, and then the second time when they saw him later in the season, and Blanco had success again, but not quite as much the first time around. And the Blue Jays going into that start, they knew exactly what Blanco was going to do. Like, they knew it was going to be off-speed heavy. They knew it was going to be a ton of sliders and changeups and curveballs, and they knew that Blanco was going to try to get Blue Jays hitters off the plate. And the approach going into that outing was, hey, be patient, like take pitches. Don't go fishing for all that off speed and spinning stuff that he's going to try to get you with early in counts. Like, see his fastball up, get to his fastball, work some deeper plate appearances. You know, if he lands a perfect slider or changeup on the edge for strike one, so be it. Like, you just have to live with that because that's not a pitch you can drive. Well, lo and behold, like 14 of Blanco's 20 outs that day on Monday came on four pitches or fewer. You know, the Blue Jays chased 30% of the pitches that Blanco threw outside the zone. A third of his sliders, a third of his changeups, 63% of his curveballs. So that plan to be patient, to lay off secondary pitches and hunt fastballs over the plate, that was not executed. And no. The Blue Jays knew what to expect. They knew what they're going to try to do against Blanco, and they did not execute it during the game. And that's why they weren't successful. And I mean, really, that comes down to the quality of plate appearance. And that comes down to following through on your preparation and following through on your plan and being disciplined and patient and deliberate. I'm not trying to say it's easy to hit big league pitching, but you're a big league hitter. Your job is to hit big league pitching. And I think that the Blue Jays were well prepared for that game by their coaching staff and their analysts and their scouts and everything that they did pregame. But once they got into the batter's box, I really do not think they executed very well on their plan.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fair for you to criticize, you know, in a very kind of clear way that's fair and backed up with facts, even if you've never stood in the box and faced major league hitting and got a pitch off of it. I think that, you know, we definitely acknowledge it's tough to do, but like you said, this is their job. This is why they're on this team. They are there to score runs and put runs up on the board. They're just not doing that. And especially against the Astros, it wasn't happening. Doesn't mean that it will continue this way. You know, in fact, I don't think that it will continue to be quite this bad. And look, big picture, at 12-13, they're in a decent position still. Like, this season isn't off to a catastrophic start. If you zoom out and just look at the overall record and where they're at health-wise and performance-wise, they're in an okay position. I wouldn't say they're in a good position, but they're in an okay position. I do think that it's worth mentioning the context of the quality of pitching they've faced. And if you look at the data, the Blue Jays have faced more velocity, harder fastballs than any team in Major League Baseball to this point in the season at an average of 94.7 miles per hour. But end of the day, like, you have the wins or you don't, and they have 12 of them, so that's not a ton. And secondly, if you're in the postseason, you do need to hit some bombs. And
do you think you're facing Ryan Gusto in the postseason?
Right. You're really not. And you might not even be facing Blanco. So you are going to be facing the Max Frieds of the world. You're going to be facing the Hunter Browns of the world, the Emmanuel Clases, the Cade Smiths, like the best pitchers in baseball. Those are the guys on the mound when it matters the most. So is Nathan Lucas going to take Max Fried deep in October? Maybe, but it's not looking good from that standpoint. It's really not.
No, I mean, the Gusto on Wednesday, and like John Schneider was up front about this, about how like the Blue Jays just were pressing in that game and had far too quick plate appearances and like weren't being disciplined, weren't executing. I mean, this is a 26-year-old rookie making his third big league start. You know, he's got a good fastball. Given that it's 94, it's got pretty good ride at the top of the zone. He's obviously got a pretty deep arsenal, but it was pretty clear that right-handers were going to get worked up and in with fastballs and down and away with sweepers, and that for lefties, he was going to just try to stay away from them and, you know, pick the outside corner. And the Blue Jays, you know, they did well not to chase him off the plate, but when they got their pitches to hit in the strike zone, again, they didn't execute on them. They whiffed through eight pitches that caught the strike zone. They put only five balls in play at 100 miles per hour plus. Two of them were outs off Addison Barger's bat. You know, and this, like, you can even trace this back to the Blanco start. I mean, they were trying to get fastballs in the zone against Blanco. Well, he threw 20 fastballs in the zone, and the Blue Jays only swung in a dozen of them. And they were good pitches to go after, the ones that they swung, and they made contact with all of them. So it's not like the pitch was like overpowering and, you know, being blown past them. It's not like they weren't seeing it, but they didn't get a hit off the fastball all night. They put only one ball in play off any pitch of any variety over 100 miles per hour that night. And that was Lucas's homer to right, which was like 102 and traveled 366. So the Blue Jays have every resource that they could need in terms of information and video, in terms of like coaches to work with, in terms of like mental performance specialists that they can talk to. Like, they've got Traject, they've got high velocity pitching machines. I mean, they have good plans and they have good information. They have an entirely new hitting staff this year than the one that they did last. They've overhauled the way that reports are written and the way that information is communicated to them. But we just aren't seeing that execution right now. And I mean, those two outings, you know, Blanco and Gusto, like, those really stand out to me, because you can write off Hunter Brown, who, like, I think if the Blue Jays had aluminum bats, they weren't going to hit him that night. Like, he was just unbelievable. It's one of the best performances I've seen from the starting pitcher all year. And you can write off like a Schwellenbach or a Strider or a Gilbert, but you really cannot write off a Ronel Blanco or a Ryan Gusto. If the Blue Jays are not going to be getting those gettable guys, they're not going to be going anywhere.
Yeah, that's for sure. And at this point in the season, I don't know about you, but for me, I'm not inclined to blame David Popkins. You know, I can't sit here and blame the hitting coach at this point. I'm not inclined to blame John Schneider. I think it's on the players. I think it's on the front office. The players, because they can execute on the field and they're the ones who actually have the chance to hit the ball, and the front office because they're the ones who put the team together and the coaching staff, the whole mechanism in place. And there is time for all this to turn around, but it's obviously contributed to the recent five-game skid. I think that's gone hand in hand with them not hitting. And I guess at this point, like, it's a question of where to go next.
Can I do one more thing, actually, though? You can, because we can even go back to the weekend. Like, the Blue Jays should have swept Seattle, honestly. When you look at the Saturday game, it was like bottom 9, bottom 10, and bottom 11, the Blue Jays had runners on third with less than two out and needed, like, I mean, anything. Like, sac fly, ground ball single, error, passed ball, like, anything to score the winning run. and could not cash those runs. Like multiple opportunities to win that game at home in extras while Yariel Rodriguez was like pitching his two best innings of the season to keep the Blue Jays like right there. And they couldn't cash those. And because like the Blue Jays super high leverage arms had been so overused to that point, because the Blue Jays have been pitching in leverage the entire season, they had to turn to Jacob Barnes, and he walks a couple, and then like Rowdy Tellez bridges him, you know, 400 feet into, you know, one of the social spaces. And then he even like, you look at Sunday's game, which was like the Easton Lucas debacle followed by like Paxton Schultz legacy game.
Yeah.
You know, like, look, that game was like 6-3 after three innings. And how many runners did the Blue Jays leave on base in that game?
They had them loaded a couple times early.
You know, they went 5-21 with runners in scoring position in that game. I mean, they started the first inning, the second inning, and the third inning with the first two runners reaching base. And then the fourth inning, Vlad led off with a double.
Ropes it into left center field. Off the wall on a bounce, and he is into second base. Another absolute bullet off the bat of Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
I mean, they just had traffic all day long, and they were not able to execute to cash those runners. And if you aren't going to hit for power, as the Blue Jays clearly haven't to this point, you need to nail the small things. Like, you need to cash runners from third base at less than two out. You need to, like, if you're getting them on, you need to get them over and get them in. Like, because you can't do neither. You can't do neither power nor stringing hits and walks together and playing like fundamental baseball. It has to be one or the other, preferably it's both, and then you're boat racing teams and you're laughing. But as long as the Blue Jays are going to be second last in baseball and home runs hit and second last in isolated power and dead last in barrel rate, they need to do a better job of executing on these opportunities that we're identifying that they've had and failed to execute against.
And I think, like, with all that said, because it's totally true, they had so many chances to win that Saturday game. And then, you know, the Sunday game, as you mentioned as well, there were opportunities that they didn't cash in on. So there you have it, five losses in a row. And I think that especially after the season that we just watched in 2024, there's a little bit of a tendency, and I get it, to go into like full doom and gloom, fold the franchise, it's over. This team is not going to be good. Like, they're never going to hit home runs again. And I get it, because last year was awful, and this year has been pretty underwhelming so far. They're 12-13. Like, they're losing more than they're winning, so it's not good by any stretch. But I do think, and I don't want to sit here and say like, oh, it's all going to be okay, because I don't know that. They might lose 88 games again. I have no idea where it's going to go. So I'm not trying to say like it's all going to be good, but I am going to say, to be 12-13, given the schedule they've had, I think it's okay, with some serious yellow to red flags as far as, you know, are they going to be able to hit enough home runs? But I think when I look at this thing big picture, I'm like, it's not great, but they're okay.
Yeah, in the context of an American League, especially where the Blue Jays have 12 wins and no team has more than 15. So this, the mid-inning of the American League has occurred, and like, the Blue Jays are going to hang around this playoff race almost by default, as long as you know, teams in the AL continue to just hang around 500. I just think that the lack of quality in this league is probably going to keep the Jays relevant like pretty deep into the season, you know, unless they like truly bottom out, which I don't think is going to happen. And you're right, like, you can't panic at this point in the season. And you can't overreact. Like, I think if you're John Schneider, Ross Atkins, the decision makers of the Blue Jays, I don't think you do anything drastic. I think you can make little tweaks, like bumping George Springer up in the lineup and bumping Andrés Giménez down. Like, I think that was a good move. I think maybe you could do something around the margin of the roster. Like, if you think that what Jonathan Class A is doing in AAA is real, and you think that he can give you, you know, more of a spark at the big league level than you're getting from like an Alan Rodon or a Nathan Lucas, then sure, you can make that move, right? You've got Dalton Varsho coming back on the weekend, so there's going to be, or potentially in Boston, we'll see, the Blue Jays are going to make, or in Toronto, excuse me, against Boston, Blue Jays are probably making that decision right now. There's going to be some natural maneuvering to come there. And look, we're only 15% of the way through the season, barely. And, you know, what you see is all there is. So, like, who's to say what the remaining 85% will look like? It's possible that this is the worst stretch of the Blue Jays season. And just because it's all that we have revealed of the full picture, that's all that we know. And who knows, maybe the Blue Jays go off from here. Like, that's possible. Like, I'm open to the possibility that this is the end of the power slumps for the top three in the Blue Jays lineup. And that over the next seven games, like, Bo, Vlad, and Santander combine for 13 or 14 home runs. Like, I think that that's realistic. They have the talent, they have the power, and they're going to go to Yankee Stadium where it's not that hard to hit home runs if you know what you're trying to do. So I'm not saying it's over. Like, I'm not saying that they need to fold the franchise, like you said, but I also cannot blame any Blue Jays fan who's like, man, this feels familiar. Like, sure, the 2025 season's a small sample, but the 2024 season, like, that's as big as a sample gets. That's 162. Yeah. And this feels really familiar to how the Blue Jays offense performed in 2024.
Do you think, you were just around the team for a few days in Houston, do you think that any of that frustration got into the clubhouse, or what do you think their vibe is?
I don't like to try to, you know, speculate on how things are in the clubhouse because I'm in there for an hour a day. And I'm just kind of saying that so fans know that, like, I don't think that any journalist can really stand here and say that we actually know the vibe of the clubhouse because we're in there an hour a day. We're not on the flights. We're
Let me rephrase that. From how the players are talking about this publicly and then how they're talking about it, you know, more casually, let's say in an off mic setting, did you sense any difference in how they might be interacting with the media, which is what we can perceive?
So what I'm hearing casually is that we face some incredible pitching to this point. It's very early in the season. And, you know, while, yes, like, guys at the top of this lineup have 100, 110 plate appearances to this point, like, they have 550 more to go, right? Like, I'm hearing about, like, knowing going into the season how challenging April was going to be. Like, the Blue Jays were well aware that they were going to play a lot of this month on the road. They were going to play a lot of it outdoors. They were going to play a lot of it against really good competition. And that road trip through Citi Field, Fenway Park, and Camden Yards was miserable. And, like, we were there for the Camden Yards portion of it when, you know, the weather turned a little bit on that final Sunday. But we were there on the Saturday.
It was awful. The weather was so bad. And yet everyone was like, oh, it's so much nicer here than it was in Boston. So it tells you it wasn't great in Boston.
People were praying to the heavens that it was like 8 degrees and lightly raining, because in Boston, I mean, I've, you know, kind of heard from people around the team, like, that's as bad of conditions as they've, like, played through in their careers. Like, it just was brutal. So nobody's panicking. Like, everybody's acknowledging that, hey, we gotta turn this thing around, like, we gotta be better. Like, nobody's happy with where they are, and all Blue Jays know, like, they see what we're seeing, you know. They're not delusional, but I think that there's a lot of, like, not our first rodeo. We've been through baseball seasons before. If we were 12-13 to begin June, nobody would be, like, you know, jumping off of bridges. It would just be a phase of a season where we're a game under 500 over 25. Like, it's just because this is all that we have right now, these first 25 games, so that's all we have to evaluate, that it gets magnified. But, you know, the flip side of that is that the Blue Jays over the last two games in Houston were pressing. Like, swings were getting big. They were trying to force the issue. You know, John Schneider said it, like, straight up. Guys are pressing, trying a little bit too hard, and that's the worst thing you can do as a baseball player, is try too hard. Like, it's Josh Donaldson was right. Like, it's not like the try league, because the harder you try, typically the worse you do. So, you know, I think that the off day on Thursday is a good opportunity for everyone to kind of, like, take a deep breath, relax, decompress, and come into the Bronx with clear heads and just a fresher perspective, because the plate appearances over the final two games in Houston, I think, really reflected some of the pressure and anxiety that these guys are feeling to produce.
Right. And, you know, the other side of that Josh Donaldson quote is, it's the get it done league, and they're not getting it done. I mean, they're not out of the race. They haven't totally played themselves into, you know, the bottom of the standings by any stretch. And certainly teams like the Orioles do have bigger concerns than the Blue Jays right now, but they're not getting it done to the extent that they could and should. So it's going to be really interesting. The series against the Yankees, it's always good theater when you have the Jays and Yankees playing in New York. And I think how Carlos Carrasco, who's the Friday night starter, how he approaches the Jays, you know, I would love to sit in on the game planning with him and Matt Blake, the Yankees pitching coach, as they try to take advantage of this Blue Jays lineup, because you have a veteran starting pitcher right there, followed by Max Fried, who's like a really good pitchability guy on the Saturday. Like, there's a scenario where these guys see what's happening in Houston, see the eagerness and the over eagerness and the pressure that the Blue Jays are under, and just keep ratcheting it up and just keep finding ways to live on the edges of the zone. Don't give them anything middle. You know, Bobichette's not up there trying to draw a walk. He had saw four pitches in the course of four plate appearances on Wednesday. So why would you ever throw, it's like Jacob Wilson of the A's, why would you ever throw Bobichette something middle? Like, it just doesn't make sense. So there's a chance for the Yankees to take advantage of this.
And it's not only the Blue Jays players who are feeling that pressure, but it's the pitchers as well. Because, look, Kevin Gausman, Chris Bassett, and Bowden Francis, like, were they spectacular in Houston? No. But were they good enough for the Blue Jays to win? Yes. Like, none of them got rocked. None of them had the best outing of their seasons, of their careers, whatever. But, I mean, Kevin Gausman was, like, throwing hard as hell, and he got a ton of swing and miss. He was finally getting whiffs with his splitter, which is not something that we had seen earlier this season, but I think his fastball was playing really well up, and he was landing his splitter a bit more on the plate, and also like mixing in a few more sliders as well, just to keep hitters off balance. And I thought he had really good, effective stuff on Friday. He just had one sort of, you know, dink and dunk, unfortunate inning where he mislocated a couple of pitches, gave up three runs or whatever it was, and like that was it. You look at Chris Bassett on the Saturday, and like he was telling me after game, like, I don't think I had a hard hit ball in play. You know, like everything off of him was, you know, fluke little lob single or like swing bunt that goes halfway up the third baseline. There was that one that went under his foot and ricocheted off second base into right field. Nothing off of him was hard hit. And just because of his style of pitching, like, he gives up a lot of soft contact. So occasionally he is going to like fall prey to the BABIP gods. You just hope that it doesn't all happen in one inning. And it did in that case. But like outside of that really hard luck little inning, like Chris Bassett looked like the like really informed Chris Bassett that we've seen all year. And then Bowden Francis didn't quite have his fastball command to begin his outing on Wednesday in the first couple of innings, like kind of, you know, paid the price for it a little bit, but then made an adjustment, got it back, started working into righties more effectively. That, you know, helped his splitter play up. And then he looked like himself the rest of the way. But, you know, the three runs that he allowed were all that Houston needed that day, because the Blue Jays only scored one. You know, so when the Blue Jays offense just is not performing, isn't even like doing the sort of small ball little things stuff that we saw from them earlier this year, where at least they're able to like scratch across 2, 3, 4 runs without a homer, when they're scoring one per game, two per game, like Blue Jays pitchers have to be perfect. So you're feeling that pressure on the mound, because like I said, Blue Jays hitters, coaches, pitchers, they all see what we're seeing. Like, they're not ignorant to this. So when you're a starter on the mound, like, you know, you have to be perfect. You can't make mistakes. You have to execute, because if you get like a bloop and a blast, that's liable to be it for the team's chances of winning that day when the offense is performing the way it is right now.
Yeah, it's not a good time for the Blue Jays offense. I think that we have definitely identified the problem. Not that it takes a great baseball mind to look and see that they've only hit 13 home runs. And yep, that is going to be a major, major factor in determining the success or lack thereof for this team. But we will return and discuss some potential solutions, whether that's call-ups, changes in approach, changes to the lineup, and some more discussion of the pitching staff when we continue on At the Letters. Welcome back to At the Letters as we continue to discuss the Blue Jays 4 weeks in to their 2025 season. Still a long way to go. And as we look ahead here, Arden, and try to figure out what can be done, do you see ways to get more out of this group of hitters?
Well, essentially, the Blue Jays have their everyday guys. So Bichette, Guerrero, Santander, Springer, Jimenez, And then you've got Alejandro Kirk starting like 4 out of 6 or 5 out of 6 and Tyler Heineman after that. And so that kind of leaves the final three spots in the order. And that's typically going to be some mixture of Roden, Wagner, Lucas, Clement, Barger. Miles Straw just doesn't start all that often and probably won't start very often when Dalton Varsho is back. And I think the Blue Jays actually like deploy those guys as optimally as possible. Like, I think they put them into good matchups. You know, I think that they're very targeted with, you know, who they use and when and why. And I think that they always preserve at least, you know, one bullet to fire late in a game in terms of a pinch hitting decision. So as I talk through it, no, I think that the Blue Jays, honestly, because look, you can make little tweaks to the batting order if you want, right? Like George Springer is having pretty, you know, leadoff ish plate appearances right now. He works an 11 pitch walk against Hader in the 9th on Wednesday. He
really good work there.
Right. He had, you know, the walk against Blanco in the Blanco start, ahead of Alejandro Kirk, who had actually a really good plate appearance following, saw like 8 pitches, and got one hit, just, you know, unfortunately grounded out on it, kind of mis-executed his swing on it. So if you want to put George Springer up the leadoff, can you believe we've gotten to that point, Ben? Like, if you want to lead off George Springer, sure. And, you know, let Bo Bichette move down because, you know, as you mentioned, 4 plate appearances, 4 swings on Wednesday. Maybe that plays a bit better further down the lineup. So maybe you go Springer 1, Vlad 2, Santander 3, Bichette 4. Fine, I'm here for that. But like, I don't think that's going to have a meaningful impact on this team's production. I think that ultimately, like, its best hitters have to be its best hitters. George Springer's been full value, but the Blue Jays just need more power out of Bichette and Guerrero, and they need more of everything offensively out of Santander. Otherwise, they just are not going to go where they're trying to go.
Yeah, yeah, clearly. And it's worth reminding people, too, that from May 1st, of 2024 to the end of the season, Anthony Santander hit 40 home runs. That's a lot of dingers. And I would not predict that that's going to happen this year. But all that to say, he is historically a streaky hitter, a powerful hitter. I don't believe that either one of those things has changed. I think that he's still going to access a lot more power than he's shown. But to chime in, I guess, on the topic of what the Blue Jays can do, I agree with you. I don't think that there's really a ton that you can do. I think it'd be fine to put Springer in the leadoff spot for a bit if you wanted to. I think Springer 4 is fine. You know, I think Andrés Giménez, they already bumped from the cleanup spot to number 5. I don't think he has to be hitting 5th either. You know, if he's hitting 7th, that's fine. You know, it's, you can let him get things sorted out. I don't think there needs to be a, you know, it's not a demotion. He's still a very important part of this team, still an everyday player, still can contribute offensively and still some bases potentially. But the way things are going right now, it doesn't have to be the number 5 hitter. Like, if you get Dalton Varsho back and you want him up there, I think that's totally fine.
So yeah, my question there is, who would be hitting 5th for you? And I guess you just answered it. It would be Varsho when he's back.
Yeah, or it could be a matchup, right? Where it's, you really like Addison Barger against a certain pitcher. You really like you know, Kirk against a certain pitcher. Different situations that could arise. I'm not saying it's necessarily a horrible thing to have Menes in the 5 spot, but I probably most days I would be inclined to have Varsho hit ahead of him.
Yeah, they typically haven't wanted to have Kirk ahead of Giménez just so that Giménez can run if, you know, yep, Kirk reaches ahead of him. And like, the, you know, the one thing Giménez has done super, super consistently this year is run the bases. And
but that's
bases.
Assuming that those guys have to be next to each other. You know, Kirk could be 5, Giménez could be 8. Giménez could be 9. You know, I don't think that's an insult to hit someone 9th.
No, but then that also means that you would have like a Roden, a Wagner, a Lucas hitting above him. And it's not like those guys are exactly tearing it up either.
Well, and that's the thing. And, you know, we talked at length last week about Roden and Wagner. And I will say Wagner looked better defensively in the week that passed by. And that's great. That's what you want to see if you're the Blue Jays. Unfortunately, neither one of those guys really looked that great offensively. So, you know, when you're looking at a couple of young players who have options remaining and, you know, still some upside that's not totally being tapped into, someone's going to go down when Dalton Varsho comes up. And, you know, I think it could be Nathan Lukas, but I think there could be a case to be made for Alan Rota now, you know, a stronger case than there was probably a week ago. So we'll see. That decision doesn't have to be made as we're recording this right now, but that's one thing. And then you mentioned Jonathan Class A earlier. He's been having a great start at AAA, controlling the strike zone, stealing bases. I think he has 11 stolen bags in AAA and hitting really well. So that's another guy to keep an eye on. I think you kind of go step by step. You start with Varsho and make Class A perform for longer before you rush to make that move. But what do you think about that, about his potential contributions here?
Well, yeah, first of all, like on Rodin, you know, love the story, love the guy, think that he's going to have a really successful big league career, but also think he could benefit from a little bit of time at AAA right now to sort it out. And I was making that case last week. So, you know, there's nothing that I've seen in the last 7 days that has changed my opinion on that. Doesn't mean he won't be back. Doesn't mean he's not going to have a solid big league career. Like, I think he will. It's not the first guy who's, you know, struggled to adjust in his first time up to the big leagues. You're just not seeing the quality of contact there at all season long. And now the swing decisions just aren't as good as, yep, as they had been prior. So it's a bad combination. So, you know, I think that when Varsho comes back, yeah, I'm kind of considering Rodin going down over Lukas. And then the, you know, the next decision to make would be whether you call up Class A for Lukas. If I'm calling up Class A, I want him playing. And I also want to know that he has made some refinements around the edges of his game, because we're still talking about a 22-year-old, and everything that you hear about him is that the tools are great, the talent is off the charts, there is like, there's something in here, but there is still quite a bit of finishing school that needs to occur at AAA. And there still is quite a bit of like situational awareness stuff, you know, kind of approach stuff at the plate, and just some of that like stuff that comes as you mature as a ball player. Like, he got up to the big leagues so early in his development last year. And I think that the Blue Jays felt, you know, if he had been in their organization all of last year, he probably doesn't make his big league debut. Like, they're probably bringing him along a bit slower. So, look, if you're going to play him regularly and you feel like he can really give you a spark, do it. He wasn't hitting the ball particularly hard earlier this year for the results that he was getting. And, you know, you'll see that with guys with like exceptional speed like he has, is they can put up like pretty good on base and, you know, pretty good batting averages because they leg out singles, or because they turn so many singles into doubles, because they put pressure on defenses, particularly at the AAA level, that stuff plays. And I think that, you know, also we've seen a lot of players who are drawing a lot of walks in AAA with ABS move up to MLB and discover, hey, not only am I dealing with a human strike zone now, but I'm dealing with pitchers who are a lot more consistent in locating their stuff. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't think that this is going to be a savior by any means, but if the Blue Jays feel like they have playing time for him and they feel like he'll be more useful than someone who they have on their roster right now, I wouldn't be against the move.
Yeah, I am more intrigued by Class A than I am by Nathan Lukas. I mean, this is a young player who's hitting 377, 936 OPS, 13 walks compared to 14 strikeouts, and 11 for 13 stealing bases, about to turn 23 years old. So this is an intriguing player. They got him back in the Jimmy Garcia trade last summer, for anyone who doesn't remember. So pretty interesting prospect. At the same time, I do agree with the playing time thing. Now that you have Varsho back, you have Varsho, you have Springer, you have Santander, you know, that's going to be three outfielders. Potentially you have another spot in there, but you also have Miles Straw to mix in. So, you know, if you do think that you can get Class A in there 3-4 days a week, you know, I'd be open to it. But this is also just not a guy who has spent tons and tons of time at AAA. He's got about one season's worth of time at AAA. I guess what I'm saying is I'd be open to it. But if you don't think you're going to have the playing time, just keep Nathan Lukas around and let the three main guys play the outfield.
Yeah, you know, as I'm kind of like looking into it right now, like, he's still not hitting the ball terribly hard. Like, his expected slug is lower than his actual slug. His expected weighted on base is much lower than his actual weighted on base. And his barrel rate is 4.8%. And look, yeah, he's not here to be a slugger, But, you know, reading that kind of tells me that, you know, this isn't exactly somebody who's been driving the ball around with authority. I'm sure he's been benefiting from his legs and perhaps from, you know, a bit of good bad ball luck in order to, you know, put up the numbers that he has been. Not to take anything away from him. But, you know, I'm furiously looking up the BABIP right now, and I would imagine it is somewhat inflated. Yeah, it's 489. So, right. You know, I think that, and look, with his legs, he'll probably always run a BABIP in like kind of the 330 range, right? Just because of how fast he is. But 489, he is due for some serious regression. The other thing is, just from what you hear talking to people with the Blue Jays about him, is that a lot of the refinements and finishing school stuff that he needs, these aren't really things that show up in a stat line and in a box score. You know, like if you aren't actually watching him play, you aren't noticing that like his first step or his jumps aren't great and that his routes to balls in the outfield aren't super. You don't notice the multiple times in the minors last year where he overslid second base on a steal attempt and was called out because of it, which is a fact. Like that happened. So, you know, I think that the thing with Lucas v. Class A is that the Blue Jays coaching staff would just trust him a lot more right now to make the routine plays, to not make, you know, have mental miscues.
Which he has had, to be fair. I mean, he got picked off in Baltimore. There's no excuse for that. So it can happen to any player, even a veteran player.
Yes, I agree with you. But I think that there would be more faith in it happening less often with Lucas than there would be with Class A, who, you know, the routes do not inspire a lot of confidence. And I think that, you know, his speed is what's kind of allowed him to outrun some of the poor routes that he's taken to balls in the minors. But, you know, the ball comes off the bat a lot faster in the big leagues, a lot more consistently. The outfields are a lot bigger and the pressure is a lot higher when you have that third deck effect.
Yeah. And whatever you think about Jonathan Class A and the various elements of his game, no one is debating the fact that he has zero home runs in AAA. So this is not a player, whatever you think of him, this is not a player who's going to come up to the major league level and change who the Blue Jays are as an offense. So fundamentally, even if you look at what they have at AAA, it's not going to shift totally. Dalton Varsho, I mean, that's a guy who can run into some balls. He could hit 20 homers between now and the end of the season. And in the context of this Blue Jays offense, I mean, that's actually kind of a big deal because they've had so few guys who have shown any semblance of power. So that's probably more than anything else. Dalton Varsho, a guy who's done it in the major leagues before and hit 20 homers a few times, that is something that can improve and just lengthen out their lineup a little bit.
Varsho hammers it deep right field, and he's left the yard again. How about a fourth home run of the spring for Dalton Varsho? That ball playing Plinko.
I think if they could cement in 15 for the rest of the season, they'd take that. Like, I think they'd sign up for that today, honestly, rather than betting on him hitting more the rest of the way. He had 18 over a full season last year.
Yeah, he's had two 20 homer seasons in his career. I'd almost roll the dice at this point because you look at the
upside.
Well, yeah, because you look at the rest of the roster. I mean, Bo Bichette's a great hitter. He's a great hitter, but it's been a long time since Bo Bichette hit a home run. You know, it's May, and I know he was injured last year, but it's been a long time since he hit a home run. And Vlad Jr. is a great hitter as well. And this is a credit to Vlad Jr. He hits a lot of singles, a lot of doubles. He does a lot of good things offensively. It's not just home runs. Santander is really the one home run hitter that they have on this roster. And Varsho, in his good years, Varsho can kind of be a home run hitter. And that might complement the rest of the roster. So I think I would roll the dice versus just locking in 15.
And honestly, like of those three at the top, Bichette, Guerrero, and Santander, Santander is actually the one who, just based off of the performance over these first 25 games, I'd say I'm most concerned about hitting a bunch of home runs this year. Like you look at the batted ball quality and the contact quality for Bichette and Vlad, like I'm very confident that the homers are going to come for those guys. Those guys each have slugging percentages around 370. So Bichette's 370 and Vlad's 372. But based on the quality of contact they've made, Bichette's expected slug is 517 and Vlad's is 515. Like those are just massive gaps. Like these are guys who are regularly hitting the ball hard, regularly barreling it, having good launch angles. Like the homers are going to come for those guys if they continue to put up this kind of contact quality. I'm very, very, very confident in that. The thing that gives me confidence in Santander is that he seems to do this every year where he has this miserable April and then hits 40 home runs from May on. But he doesn't have like the same under the hood case to be made where he's got much better expected numbers than his actual numbers, or where his quality of contact has been so good that it's like shocking that you know, more balls haven't left the yard. Like Santander's got a 4.3% barrel rate. Bo Bichette's is double that, and Vladdy's is nearly triple that. So he has not been impacting the ball in the way that he needs to be if he's going to be hitting a bunch of homers this year. Like he really does need this to be like the worst month of his season, as it has been historically, but you know, that's never a guarantee that that's what's going to happen again.
Right. And I think too, like barrel rate, these, even these underlying statistics at this point in the year, we have to be careful in the way we use them, because, you know, for someone like, let's say a Tommy Edman, who's off to a scorching start, or like a Wilmer Flores, guys who are just, you know, hitting well above their career norms. They've got 7-8 home runs already at this point in the season. I don't have their Savant pages in front of me, but I guarantee it's like all red. They are barreling everything. They've got barrel rates that are probably double digits, 15%, whatever it is. It's incredible under the hood because it's just worked out really well. Now, as you and I know, and just a worthwhile reminder, I'm sure a lot of our listeners know this too, but that doesn't mean it's going to continue at that rate. And I think it's easiest to see with players who have these established norms, like a Tommy Edman, where it's like, yeah, we kind of know Tommy Edman might run into 15 or 20, but he's not going to be up there with your absolute sluggers at the end of the season. So that applies to the Blue Jays as well. Some of these guys have really bad expected stats right now. It's just because they've taken bad swings. It's still a small sample. They just haven't had good at-bats. They haven't found the barrel enough. It's not to excuse it, but it doesn't mean that it is going to continue in this way. So they need to find solutions and they need to do better. But that doesn't mean that they're doomed to continue in this way.
Yeah, no, and that's why I say like Vlad and Bo have to continue having the contact quality that they've had to this point. And if they do, I'm very confident that like their results, their counting stats will come around. And I think the important like context and nuance there is that, so Tommy Edman has a 10.7% barrel rate this year. His career average is 5.2. So right, clearly he is outperforming what he typically does. But, you know, Bo, 8.6%, right in line with his career average of 9%. Vladdy, 11.7% this year, career average of 11.7%. And we know that like when Vlad's barrel rate is there, he's capable of 30 plus home run seasons. Like we've just seen it over and over again. Bo, we know that when his barrel rate, when his contact quality is where it is right now, sustained over a full season, as we've seen before, that he's capable of 20, 25 homers. So that's why I'm confident that like those guys, if they keep doing what they've been doing, the homers are going to continue. And that's why if Tommy Edman was on the Blue Jays, I'd be saying, hey, this looks unsustainable based on the track record and his historical results.
Yeah, exactly. Now, good for the Dodgers. They banked a couple extra wins probably because of that. So they're in a great spot standings wise. Jays less so. Last thing for me on offense is just to keep in mind, for any discussion about offense, the league average, 238. League OBP, 314, league slug, 388, and league OPS, 702. Just worthwhile context to keep in mind anytime you see a slash line. In my mind, like honestly, Arden, in my head, the league average is 255, 330, 415. Like that's in my head.
That's like a top five team, dude.
Yeah, that would be a really good. So I have to make that adjustment. I don't know why that's the average in my head. I guess it's some amalgamation of like what it's been in recent years, but it's not that right now. So I remind myself of that, might be useful for other people as well.
Yeah, I mean, pitching keeps getting better and better. We keep seeing, you know, the league-wide batting average go down and down every year, and particularly in April. Like, offense is always slow to start. It always gradually improves through, you know, May and especially June and July. I remember last year around mid-May, like, there was a lot of panic about how far down offense was, right? And it regressed. It crept back. It normalized as summer went on. So, yeah, like, right now, you know, offense is down. league-wide. There's a lot of podcasts in other cities that are having similar conversations about how, you know, their team is struggling to score runs, unless you're, you know, the Yankees or the Cubs, essentially, or the Dodgers or the Padres, right? Like, unless you're one of the best teams in baseball.
There are some good teams out there, but yeah, so hopefully some fans are out there having happy podcasts at this point in the season. But it's a cruel sport, so I don't know.
But, you know, I think the Mariners at the letters is having a similar discussion. And I think that, you know, Giants at the letters is having the same discussion, right? Like, I think, you know, Tigers at the letters is having the same discussion. And, you know, those are teams that are trying to contend and trying to be good. But, you know, even in that context, like, even with how depressed, like, offensive stats are across baseball right now, the Blue Jays are still well below that average. Like, it must be said. Like, it's like, it doesn't change the fact that the Blue Jays as a team have a 95 weighted runs created plus, which means that their offense is 5% below league average. That's in the bottom third of the league.
No, exactly. So to be very clear, the offense has not been good enough, is not in a good spot. No one is saying otherwise.
You heard it here first.
Yeah. Just in case any doubt remained, in case anyone's wondering what the state of the offense was. But let's shift over to pitching, because that has quietly continued to be mostly pretty good for the Blue Jays. Easton Lucas was absolutely rocked by the Seattle Mariners on the weekend. Not really too much to add about that one, but it does create an opening for the Blue Jays. They're going to have to figure this out, not this weekend against the Yankees, but next week when they come back home and face the Boston Red Sox. They're going to have to figure out a fifth starter spot. So what's your read on Max Scherzer and how they continue to backfill for him?
All right, so do you want to start with the Scherzer update?
Let's start there.
Just to provide that context. So Max was in Houston back from his visit to another hand specialist about a week ago now. So last Thursday, where he got a second cortisone shot. And that's not because the first cortisone shot was ineffective. The first cortisone shot was in one of the joints in his thumb, and the second cortisone shot was in a different joint in his thumb. So if you look down at your thumb, like, you've kind of got those three joints, right? You've got one near the fingertip, one in line with your knuckles, and then one close to your wrist. Scherzer, throughout this odyssey that he's been through over the last couple of years, has had like cortisone shots into all three of them. And so far this season, he's had cortisone shots into two of them, because after the first cortisone shot resolved issues in one joint, then the other joint started bothering him as he was trying to throw again. So it's possible there's another cortisone shot coming if the third joint starts acting up. Like, Max Scherzer is as in the woods about this as anyone. You know, those are his words, that he is not out of the woods on this. But he was throwing from flat ground in Houston. He said he felt as good as he has throwing in a while, that he's, you know, able to get a better grip on his secondary pitches, which is very important for him to create the action and manipulate the baseball the way that he needs to. But it really is like a day-by-day process here of just how it responds, how it feels. You know, every day before a 7 o'clock game, he goes out to left field around 2:30 with like Jose Ministral, the Blue Jays head trainer, and Andrew Pipkin, their medical coordinator or director, whatever they're calling it. And, you know, Pete Walker will go out there and he'll throw and he'll talk to them and he'll throw some more and he'll talk to them. So this is, you know, very much like, we'll see. Like, this is very much in limbo here, depending on how he feels. What I'm confident in saying is that we will not see Max Scherzer on the mound for the Blue Jays anytime soon, because he has not thrown a pitch from a mound in like 3.5 weeks now. He's essentially back to square one of spring training. So when he does start again, it's going to be that like deliberate buildup process that you see in spring. It's going to be like, get on a mound and, you know, throw 30 pitches and then throw 45 and then throw 60 and then face hitters and then a bullpen and then a sim game and then a rehab outing and another and another. So I'm looking at like June at this point, Ben. I don't know if you disagree, but even just from talking to Max in Houston, I'm like, I would completely write off May for his return.
Well, let me put it to you this way. If you could have, if you're the Blue Jays and you could have Max Scherzer starting June 1st, like, would you lock that in? Because I would.
1,000%. Yeah. No, and I don't think that's going to happen. But
no, yeah. I mean, we'll see, but yeah.
The point here is that this is going to be an opening in the rotation for some time.
Yes. That is good to know, even just hearing that kind of behind the scenes, what's actually going on, what does his day look like. We all know he's intense. We all know he wants to be out there and he's contributing some value in the meantime with his presence, but presence, yeah, it's not as good as having a fifth starter or a third starter, you know, which he clearly has the potential to be when he's on the mound. So in the meantime, we saw Paxton Schultz look honestly incredible. The swings and misses, 8 strikeouts in his major league debut, contributing to a franchise record 19 strikeouts by the Blue Jays in a 9-inning game. Paxton Schultz, not a top prospect, not someone who arrives to the major leagues with either a ton of hype, prospect pedigree, or frankly stuff, but he got amazing results. What do you think they do with that spot moving forward?
Quick aside, you mentioned like Scherzer's like contributions, you know, when he's around the team and not pitching. Like, we show him on the broadcast all the time in the dugout, like talking to John Schneider, talking to Pete Walker, like hanging around with the coaches in game. And I asked him the other day, and like, bless his honesty, I said, like, hey, what are those conversations like? Like, what's it like strategizing with those guys? And he was like, you think we're strategizing? We're just like giving each other grief. So he said that he was more a source of humor than a source of strategy in those moments. So, you know, there's different ways to contribute, I guess. But so what do they do with this spot? Well, for now, they're just going to skip it because they're going to bring back Kevin Gausman and Chris Bassett to start on Saturday and Sunday in New York, leveraging Thursday's off day. Now, this is the third year in a row that we've seen the Blue Jays go to a 4-man rotation.
This is for one turn, though, right?
Correct. But yeah, they are going to a 4-man rotation due to a lack of a viable alternative to fill in the fifth spot. They don't want to do this. Like, no, they would rather that Easton Lucas hadn't gotten blown up in his last couple of outings and was a viable option, because Kevin Gausman is 34 and Chris Bassett is 36. So you don't really want to, like, if you can get an extra day of rest for these guys, the stats bear it out that they're better with that extra day of rest. I'm sure subjectively they feel better with that extra day of rest. I'm sure their stuff objectively measures better with that extra day of rest. Even just intuitively, it makes sense that you would want to build in as much rest for these guys as you can, because they are so critical to the team and they carry so many innings and they have carried so much workload over the last several years. So if the Blue Jays had a viable fifth starter, they wouldn't be doing this. But for now, they're going to a 4-man rotation for the third year in a row because they don't have another alternative. And they are, you know, they have said they're only going to do it this one time, and they are going to have a fifth starter. That would be the second game of the Red Sox series in Toronto later this month. I believe it's the Wednesday. I don't have a sense of who that's going to be. I think the options would be bullpen day, which, you know, Paxton Schultz would probably log the majority of the innings in that game, or like have the bulkiest outing, but it might be behind an opener. I think that Jake Bloss could be an option. He pitched well his last time out for Buffalo. He's been inconsistent this year. And it's probably kind of hard to, you know, trust him just based on that inconsistency and just how wildly his results have fluctuated. But his last time out, he had 19 swinging strikes and a really solid outing, and it's hard to fake 19 whiffs in an outing. So if he can do something close to that again, he's going to put himself into good position. And then there's Eric Lauer, who's off roster right now, so it would be it would require a roster move to get him on if he was going to pitch. Or you could IL somebody and bring Easton Lucas back, but you know, we kind of saw how that went the last two times out, so there really isn't like a strong option here for the Blue Jays. Like, they are going to be picking amongst, you know, a variety of somewhat mediocre ones.
Yeah, the Easton Lucas option, people might hate me for this, so I accept it if people don't like this take. But in a weird way, like, he was effective against the Red Sox, and the Red Sox do have a lot of lefties in their lineup. Like, it's actually, if you're not counting on him to give you 5 innings, but if he is kind of part of a broader plan, maybe with a Paxton Schultz, like, you could kind of use Easton Lucas to first face the first 9 batters of the game. Then by the time he gets to Bregman and Story, the right-handed hitters, flip it, Paxton Schultz, boom, bullpen game. Like, I actually don't hate that idea, but as you said, right now he's not on the major league roster, so there would have to be an injury to permit him to come back.
Yeah, the danger is that the Red Sox have now seen him. So maybe the second time around, things go a little bit differently.
Oh, none of these options are great. Like, it's only, we're only trying to find the best of the not good options.
right? Like you're counting on him going, you know, toe to toe with Garrett Crochet as he did that last time out.
Hey, it worked once.
It did work once. But, you know, the Red Sox now have the video and they've now had live looks at him and they can, you know, they can get the traject more fine tuned on what he's going to utilize and what sequences he likes to use against them. And he'll know some tendencies. So it could go differently. They haven't seen Eric Lauer yet. And he's a lefty. He's hasn't been like dominant with Buffalo, but he's a guy who's pitched well at the big league level in the past. Like this is somebody with like nearly 600 big league innings. And he was pretty solid as recently as 2021 and 2022. So that's an option, but, again, he's off the 40 man right now. So you would have to open up a 40 man spot, which would mean DFAing someone, or I don't know if like Ryan Burr would be an option to go on the 60 or something like that. So I think the cleanest option is probably bullpen day, but we'll see.
Yeah, I agree. Bullpen day, it's never great, but there are ways to kind of make it work. I do want to, as long as we're talking pitching here, I want to shout out Brendan Little because he's really off to a great start. And when you pair it with the work of Jimmy Garcia and Jeff Hoffman, who, I mean, just incredible. Those guys have been so good. But then actually to mix in Brendan Little, like, I think he deserves some credit. 18 strikeouts in 10 and two thirds. This is a guy who has really stepped in to that number one lefty role, and it's answering a pretty big question for the Blue Jays. So just wanted to note that as long as we're talking pitching here.
Got him. Again, look at the movement. That's the sinker. His bread and butter, and he strikes out Albies. Called strike three. Brendan Little with three strikeouts around a walk. Keeps it 1-0.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. He comes in the other day to relieve Chris Bassitt in, I guess it was the first, no, the second game in Houston. And like he walks Cam Smith on a full count pitch to load the bases with one out. And then he strikes out Jose Altuve and gets Yordan Alvarez out on a fly ball. Like the, you know, those are just like the two best hitters in the Astros lineup. And like he was getting them to whiff. Like he was, you know, he quick AB against Alvarez. It was like 0-2 and then the fly out. Bases loaded, really big spot. Like, you know, Blue Jays could not afford to go behind any further than they already were at that time. He came in with runners on. I thought he pitched really, really well there. You know, the one thing with Little is that, like, you definitely need a catcher behind the plate who is on their toes and ready to block pitches because he's very liable to spike one. Like, his stuff just moves so much.
Well, that curveball. It's so
good. It's crazy. No, it is, but he's very liable to spike it. So, like, you really do need a catcher who is ready to block pitches, particularly with runners on second and third, because he's going to bounce some in there.
It's a good problem to have when a pitcher is so nasty that it puts extra pressure on the catcher. And the curveball, hitters batting a combined 0.91 against it. They're slugging 1.82 against it. The whiff rate is outrageous on that pitch. It's 72%. So this is a really, really good pitch that Brendan Little has, and he's using it effectively. So that's big for the Jays bullpen. You just watched this pitching staff in Houston up close. Did anything stand out to you as far as, you know, maybe some of the smaller things on the edges or kind of the big guys? I mean, you saw Gausman, Bassitt, and Francis pitching against a very good Astros lineup. So what stood out to you?
Yeah, I would shout out the first two guys. And, you know, start with Kevin Gausman. He's had this, like, just this weird odyssey he's been on with his splitter over the last year and change, where it's been getting like way too much horizontal movement. And that's really messed up his ability to tunnel the pitch and his ability to be deceptive with it and play it off of his fastball. I think that hitters are better able to recognize it when it's moving horizontally. They're better able to like spoil it when it's moving horizontally, or to, you know, judge where it's going to end up. And when he leaves it on the plate, I think they're better able to barrel it as well. So he really needs to be getting like more vertical on his splitter, more depth than the horizontal. And he's been doing, you know, there's been all kinds of adjustments that have been going on behind the scenes in order to get him that, you know, whether it's like moving on the rubber or it's mechanical tweaks. He's had some grip changes, and, you know, he'll admit the shape still isn't where he wants it to be, but the splitter was like a lot more effective against the Astros his last time out. Like, he was getting those swings and misses. He was throwing some that, you know, started thigh high and then dropped beneath bats. You know, he was landing some in the zone, which is important for him and something that he wants to do a little bit more often. He had a Calder swinging strike with 31% of the splitters that he threw in that outing. So I think that was like an important step for him. You know, he's not out of the woods on it yet. It's still got a bit too much horizontal on it. And, you know, talking to Pete Walker, you know, the Blue Jays just would kind of, they feel like it's just a little bit inconsistent right now. Like, sometimes he'll throw that one with that depth and that nasty drop, but then other times, you know, it's getting more horizontal. So they just haven't really quite figured it out yet. But, you know, I think that Gausman is getting closer, and I think that, you know, they solved the velo issue. Like, he is throwing with as much velocity as we've seen him throw with. Like, he was up to 98 the other night. So if the splitter is getting close and they can get it back to, you know, something resembling what it was, you know, over his first couple of years with the Blue Jays, like, he could get back to that ace level guy, because it's when you have the velo and you have the splitter moving the way that you want it to, like, that's his whole game is fastballs up, splitters down, ton of swinging strikes, putting hitters away quickly, not walking anybody, not giving up bombs. So I thought that, you know, even though Gausman gave up some runs in that outing, I thought that just in terms of like the effectiveness of his pitches and some of the metrics behind them, that was one of the more encouraging outings I've seen from him in some time.
Yeah, that's a big deal. And as you said, the velocity, I mean, to be where it is, that's really encouraging. And it is a departure from last year when he was fighting that shoulder to start the season. Just having him healthy, that's a big difference. And then if he can refine the off speed to the point that, you know, he's really cooking with it, then so much the better.
And then the other one is Bassett, who, like, yes, he's off to like obviously a tremendous start this year. Like, the ERA is below 2, and like, he's legitimately been one of the 10 best starters in baseball this season. But you can actually like trace this run he's on back to like his final 5 starts of 2024 after he moved on the mound to the third base side. Like, if you take those final 5 starts of 24 and the first 5 of 25 and put them together, it's a 2-3 ERA with a 25% strikeout rate. He hasn't allowed a home run in his last 44 innings. And this is a guy who allows home runs. You know, this year, Chris Bassett, who is always someone who, you know, works effectively like to the edges and stays off the heart of the plate, is locating nearly half, like 49% of his pitches on the edges of the strike zone, around what like Zach Cass would qualify as the shadow zone. So that's one ball width, either inside or outside the strike zone. Like, that's elite. That is a top 5 mark in this game. Like, he is commanding and locating so, so well. And it's really impressive to me because he's like recently moved on the mound. So he's like recently changed all of his attack angles to the plate. He went from all the way on the first base side all the way over to the third base side. And the idea was like for him to locate better arm side against lefties. You know, he like Bassett originally moved to the first base side early in his career so that he could like work inside to lefties and like really attack the glove side. But I think that, you know, he got to a point where it felt like he wasn't being as consistent arm side away from lefties, and therefore they were kind of eliminating that half of the plate and weren't really guarding against it. So, you know, I think moving him to the third base side, the idea is that like he can work effectively inside with his cutter, inside with his breaking balls, but then also have that arm side lane for the sinker, the splitter, you know, those pitches that move to his arm side. And now lefties really have to like honor the outer third of the plate and guard against those pitches inside there, so effective against them. Like, you look at his cutter through his first 5 starts this year, lefties are, you know, whiffing at it a third of the time. He's used that cutter to finish 8 of his 17 strikeouts against lefties so far. Lefties have put his cutter in play only 4 times, ground out, fly out, and 2 singles. So like, that's been a tremendously effective pitch for him against lefties. We're aware of the issues that Bassett has had against lefties over the last couple of years. It really feels like he's discovered something here by moving to the third base side and changing his sequencing a little bit and just moving in and out effectively. And then you layer on like that elite command to the edges that we've seen from him. And that's why he's been as good as he's been so far this season.
And for anyone who wants to visualize that, they can check out your piece at sportsnet.ca to kind of get a look at what exactly it is you're talking about there. But yeah, that's a big deal because Bassett, the ultimate finesse pitcher, no surprise to anyone that he would try to find a little edge by moving, you know, from one side of the rubber to the other, really anything that a pitcher can do. He's going to try to pull on that lever and see where it leads him. So before we step aside for the week here, I do just want to look ahead to this 6-game stretch for the Blue Jays here at Yankee Stadium, then home against the Red Sox. That will take them to May 1st, and it will end a really, really tough stretch of schedule. It's not an easy schedule at any time, but this is a notably tough stretch of schedule. And I would say that if the Blue Jays come out of that stretch 3-3, they're 15-16 overall at that point. That's okay. It's not great, but I think that would be okay. I don't think you really have a lot of room to go 1-5 here, because then it starts getting really rough, just considering they lost 5 in a row going into this thing. But I think if they go 3-3, that would be fine. Where do you stand on this next 6 games to wrap up a really, really tough stretch to begin this season?
Yeah, you want to be able to budget them for a winning record over these 6, but like, it's going to be really tough in the Bronx this weekend, I think. Like, the Yankees are just playing so, so well. We've seen the Blue Jays perform well against the Red Sox earlier this season when they went to Boston, won 3-4. And, I mean, they got walked off in the last one. So it was, like, actually nearly a 4-game sweep in Boston. So, like, we know the Blue Jays can contend with them, but like, to me, it would be a surprise, a very pleasant one for the Blue Jays, but a surprise if they won 2 of 3 in the Bronx. So then, like, essentially to get to, if they go 1-2 in the Bronx, then you're asking for them to sweep the Red Sox in order to have a winning record over these next 6. So I agree with you, like, 3-3 seems realistic. That gets you 1 game under 500, like a fifth of the way into your season. That's okay, particularly in the context of an American League where like nobody is separating themselves. But I will say, like, you got the Guardians coming in after that, and like, that's a team that's 14-10 this year. They're winning. They just took 2 of 3 from the Yankees after sweeping the Pirates in Pittsburgh, which, like, you know, Pittsburgh not an amazing team, but you know, we're gonna get to see Cleveland against Boston this weekend, and I expect that to be a pretty competitive series. Like, they've been a good team so far this year. As much as I thought they were really gonna take a step back after the offseason that they had, and you know, certainly their offense hasn't been spectacular, their pitching staff has really been carrying the weight for them. So the Blue Jays have contended with some pretty tough pitching of late. You mentioned how they're going to see Freed this weekend in the Bronx, and then, you know, you got Cleveland coming in, and then you've got at Seattle early in May, one of the best pitching staffs in baseball, and then you've got the Rays, who pitch really well, and the Tigers have some really good pitching, and then you got the Padres after that, and the Rays again, and the Rangers after that. I'm sorry to say, like, the schedule isn't getting a whole lot easier through the majority of May.
Yeah, at a certain point you got to make your move, and that doesn't have to happen now. It could happen in May or June or July, but at some point you have to make your move. And we can say that so far that has not happened for the Blue Jays. So we will continue seeing where it goes. Arden, anything else to add before we step away for the week?
That is every thought that I have, having just gotten off a flight from Houston. I gave you everything.
No rest for you. A day off for the Blue Jays. And we will talk to you very soon. But in the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Arden for getting off a plane and right into the podcast studio. And thanks to Christian Ryan for producing this episode of At the Letters.